15-60 Western Conference edition of the Dunk Time Basketball Podcast today. Brought to you today by our sponsor, Postmates. You can basically get anything delivered whenever you want in any major U.S. city using the Postmates app. Joining me to talk about the 15 teams of the Western Conference, Danny LaRue.
How you doing, man?
Really good. We just got back from Warriors Clippers, which unfolded in large part, I think, how people probably thought that it would. But why don't we use that opportunity to talk about these two teams first, and then we'll get to the two other playoff teams that played tonight, Houston and Utah, before we go through the rest in alphabetical order. Now that we've set the scene, today's game, what were your thoughts?
So I think one thing that you noted that really stuck with me was that it looked like the Warriors were playing something closer to their playoff rotation, and it was the first time that we've seen that while Iguodala has been out. And I think they just thought this wasn't a notable game for them. The Clippers are their most likely second-round opponent. And, you know, they played pretty well. They got a lot of good fortune from the Clippers missing shots they usually make. But that, you know, that sort of thing does happen.
Yeah, the Clippers overall didn't really shoot that poorly until the fourth quarter. I noted what you did about the rotation as well. Steve Kerr, in his press conference before the game, talked about how really the 73 wins was something that was going to happen, that they're going to, not that it's going to happen, but they're really going to kind of go for it, and, you know, unless guys are injured, and that's really what they did tonight. Anderson Varejao, Ian Clark, both excised from the rotation, despite the fact that they had just finished a 6-9 stretch and had flown back from Minnesota, you know, really pretty darn close to an East Coast road trip for a West Coast team to go to San Antonio, Dallas, and Minnesota before you fly back. Sean Livingston played more. They played Draymond Green at center in the first half, and then probably for, you know, maybe about 30% or so of the second half. Barely played Spates even. So it was really kind of more a playoff rotation, like you said.
Let's go through the basic numbers with them just so we have it in there. They're 64-7, 9-1 since the last time we did this, and 538 gives them a projected 73-9 record, 98% chance at the number one overall seed, and 40% title odds.
It's insane that it's that low, isn't it?
The title odds?
Yeah, after what they've done this year.
It is pretty incredible.
You know, I thought in this game we worried a little bit in our episode about Monday's game that Steph Curry was lacking his usual verve. I didn't think that that was necessarily the case this time. It was not quite a transcendent game for him, but he at least was attacking off the dribble when he got switched onto. Again, it was the Clippers switching everything. We'll talk more about that when we get to the Clippers. But that seems to be the strategy now, is you're just going to run Steph off the line, force him to make layups. And without Iguodala out there, when he's playing more with guys like Livingston, guys like Barbosa on that second unit, the strategy is really to make him drive, because then you can actually get help in a more conventional sense, and you're not giving up a three to a great shooter. In fact, the Clippers guarded Sean Livingston with their center, something that I think Oklahoma City was one of the first teams to do, and that, again, proved pretty effective.
So do you think they're going to make it, like, because I keep on thinking they've had a couple listless games recently that they've won. Do you think they're going to make it through this stretch, let's say all the way to the Jazz game, unscathed?
Well, it's just Dallas and Washington and Philly.
Yeah, that's
between
true.
Now and then, right?
Oh, and Boston, but no, Boston's not what they were.
Boston is after the Jazz game. But, yeah, Boston is starting to kind of get their mojo back a little bit. But although they won today, I think Lowry didn't play today. I thought I saw a tweet on that. But anyway, that's irrelevant. This is what happens when you're recording at 11:46 at night. But, yeah, I think they're going to get there. I think they're, other than San Antonio, I don't see any game that I'm that worried about them losing at home, frankly. I mean, this crowd, you know, this game had the feel, right, of, oh, they're only up two at the half, the other team's playing well. But the difference is at home, they just sort of inexorably start to strangle teams, and they get up by 10 at the end of the third quarter, whereas when they're on the road and they don't have it, then those games kind of seem to end up coming down to the wire, like, say, that Minnesota game.
Do you want to transition to the Clippers?
Yes. The Clippers, I thought, actually played really well tonight just from a process standpoint. Chris Paul was hitting a lot of his, or missing a lot of the shots that he normally would hit. You know, that elbow jumper going to his right just was not working for him today. He even got ripped up once by Steph Curry in pretty ugly fashion. J.J. Redick had a ton of open shots that he was unable to convert on, which he generally has been doing this year. Obviously, the bench got slaughtered. I mean, I think that's obviously the biggest problem for the Clippers. Maybe if Blake Griffin returns, that's something that they could do. And Doc Rivers did actually adjust after they were negative 12, the bench, in the begin, like first 3-4 minutes of the second quarter. Doc did take JJ out earlier in the third, brought him back to play with that bench unit. He was, that at least gave them somewhere to go other than just Jamal Crawford jacking up shots. JJ wasn't able to hit, but you know, the process was at least slightly better against the Warriors bench unit, although they again hemorrhaged points in the fourth quarter.
To me, the big takeaway from the Clippers side was that DeAndre Jordan was fantastic in this game. I think it was one of his best defensive games I've ever seen him play. He did a nice job on Curry. It seemed like he was everywhere, and what you want to see with him beyond the switching and some of the flexibility he provided there is affecting shots at the rim. That's something I've been critical of him in the past, that it seems like he's more of a block hunter than a shot changer, but he did a great job in this game of doing both.
Yeah, he was a major problem for the Warriors at the basket, especially in the first half. There was one point at which I think they were 1-for-6 on shots that he had contested, and then he'd scared them out of like 2 or 3 more layups, and that began to wane a little bit, especially as he began to switch out on the perimeter more. But he did a great job of that, and I asked Doc Rivers about it after the game.
Coach, you had DJ switching out quite a bit on Steph Curry. How do you think he did with that, and is that a strategy you feel like you can go to often during the playoffs?
I'll let you know about the playoffs. We got to get to them first. But, yeah, I liked it. You know, Curry got some, you know, garbage baskets at the end of the game. But overall, I didn't mind at all how we played him. There are other guys that hurt us tonight. Klay Thompson was huge for them tonight. So DJ can guard anybody, and I think he proved that tonight.
So I don't know. Doc didn't get to the part about the playoffs. It's partially because I kind of inartfully asked that question, and not something that coaches really want to talk about at this point of the year. But is that a sustainable strategy for this Clippers team to just switch everything like this?
I think you can do it in stretches, but I don't think it can be your real modus operandi against a team as good as the Warriors, because Curry is generally very good at handling those, and DeAndre did a great job today, but it's hard to expect that that's going to happen game in, game out. And I'm intrigued to see how that would work with Blake Griffin out on the floor.
Yeah, I think Blake can do an okay job on Steph as well. Steph just didn't do, he was better than in the Minnesota game and the San Antonio game, but he didn't do the greatest job. He got trapped along the sideline a lot. There's times when there would be a guy in the strong side corner and Steph just didn't have the room to really maneuver to where if he could have backed DeAndre out and really attacked from the top, that's when he can really kill those guys, because they have to get out so far on him that he can build up speed and go around him and really create separation. DeAndre was actually able to bother his layups on occasion. And also with Livingston out there, they were able to get more help on those drives, like I mentioned. I thought actually the Diet Coke of Death lineup without Andre worked a little bit better offensively with Rush out there, since he can just hang out in the corner and he's a guy who's a 40% three-point shooter when he's wide open. I don't know if it's going to be a sustainable strategy for the Clippers. It's definitely what everyone is doing against the Warriors lately. It seems to have slowed them down slightly. But I still think that over the course of a 7-game series, they're going to be able to attack that too much, especially when Draymond Green can get down in the post. We didn't see that much of that today, but if he gets a smaller guy, he can do that. Klay Thompson, even if he gets a shorter guard on him, that guy either just can't help at all, or even if he helps like 2 steps off, he can be there where he'd be contesting for a normal guy, but Klay will just shoot right over someone like that with that high release. And you know, he made 3 or 4 jumpers with guys just standing right there at his feet and just couldn't do anything about it.
One thing I wanted to mention, it doesn't include tonight's game, but per Ben Golliver, Sports Illustrated, since the All-Star break, the Clippers have scored 112 points per 100 possessions with Chris Paul on the floor and 91 without him.
Yeah, we sure saw that today, right? That they just couldn't score without him. And that's long been the case. Doc Rivers did his best in the fourth quarter by bringing J.J. Redick back to help out, but he could not undo the damage that Rock Divers has done to this bench. Jeff Green was horrible today, I thought. Even though he scored, you know, 15 points, I thought he really was a big-time negative for the Clips.
Yeah, he had a couple of plays where he was just ambitious with the drive and continued through it and got, I think he got 1 or 2 and ones, and that was a positive. But other than that, it was, you know, he wasn't providing a lot of value out there. And he is somebody who is very comfortable doing things that aren't necessarily helpful for the team, like post-ups and things like that. And of course, some of that is the players and the coach for calling it, but whenever a player is comfortable doing those kind of things, it concerns me. It's actually something similar to what has bothered me about Andrew Wiggins.
They ran two after-timeout post-ups for Jeff Green, guarded by Draymond Green. I'll let you surmise how those two worked out. And then also just when Jeff would be guarding Draymond at the top of the key two, three times, Draymond just blew right by him without a screen, without anything. I mean, Draymond Green, he's not exactly like breaking off advanced dribble moves. He just puts his head down and goes to one side or the other, and Jeff Green could not keep up with them. So yeah, it was just, you know, he had a couple of impressive and ones, and then overall just really didn't help at all, was not spacing the floor. He's not shooting the ball well as a Clipper from the three-point line. And also, even if he were, there weren't enough guys on the floor really to set him up for those threes. Paul Pierce, they've gotten, that's something that really is kind of, everyone just even forgotten he's on the team. Basically, he was their big offseason acquisition who was supposed to like really help them. He just, you know, hits a couple of threes every game and that's about it. You know, he tried to do his old, like get the 1-3 pick and roll switch and like kind of post up Dirk style from the free throw line, and Steph Curry just ripped him up and got a layup. I mean, it was not particularly impressive from Pierce. I don't think he really can be a factor in a series against the Warriors.
Two small things. One, we neglected to mention that awesome left-handed Curry pass when we were talking about the Warriors. That was fantastic. And two, the development since the All-Star break has basically crystallized the Clippers as the four seed. It, you know, they had maybe a little bit of an opportunity when Oklahoma City stumbled, but they just...
Yeah, they were only like 1.5 games behind or something at one point when Oklahoma City had that 3-6 stretch, but now the Clippers have had a 3-6 stretch of their own, and they're at 43-27, 51-31 projected record, which is 5 games behind Oklahoma City's projected record.
Yeah, so it looks like they're going to be there, and the Warriors have a 98% chance of the one seed, so it looks like we'll see this if each team can get past their first round opponent as the second round series.
That's awesome. You want to drive down to LA and cover those road
Absolutely.
Games?
Absolutely.
Yeah, all right, sounds good. Utah and Houston. Utah had a dramatic win on a Derek Favors dunk with 1.5 seconds remaining, putting them up to win the game. Disappointing loss for Houston at home. But the Utah win was especially impressive, and we'll talk a little bit more about this game, because they've just been so horrendous in clutch situations so far this year.
Yeah, it's been a lingering story. We've talked about it a couple of times. But so including their performance today, which was, you know, clearly one of their best, they are, okay, so since New Year's, which is about when Rudy came back, they get outscored by 12.7 points per 100 possessions, and that was below 15 before tonight's game. And since they got Shelvin Mack, you think, oh, well, maybe it got better. They got a guy who can run their offense. Nope. They've been outscored by 21.9 per 100 in 34 minutes since they got him. So that is a big part of it, and the crunch time defense is a big part of that. You would think we'd be an offensive failing, but it's been a lot of it has been defense.
Yeah, it has been, and I'm not sure a lot of the games that I've watched theirs lately, they have actually gone with Trevor Booker as the four-man, Trey Lyles on occasion, but we have not seen as much of Gobert. For this Houston team that was playing Dwight Howard at center, I was pretty surprised that they did not have Gobert in there. I mean, he's just so much better of a basketball player than Trevor Booker is. And this is one of those games, I'll probably talk more about this with Seth. He's going to come on for a mailbag while you're on vacation. But so many times coaches will say, oh, Trevor Booker, he's got 10 points on 5 of 6 shooting today. We should leave him in the game. And yeah, but Rudy Gobert is way better than Trevor Booker. There's like Trevor Booker could have had 35 points in the game, and I still would close the game with Rudy Gobert, because that's how big of a gap there is between those two players. Now,
especially with the Houston driving
okay.
based offense.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like Houston has so much shooting at the four. I mean, they were going relatively big. They had Michael Beasley out there for relatively large portions of crunch time as well. Like the Beasley stats are pretty hilarious so far since he joined the Rockets. But so I don't know. That bothered me. But hey, it worked in this particular game for Quinn Snyder, and maybe, you know, Gobert has been out there in clutch time in some of these games, and that wasn't worked. So maybe Quinn is kind of searching to try and find something in these clutch situations. But, you know, I think Rudy Gobert should be out there on the floor in crunch time. That's my personal opinion, no matter what, like Trey Lyles or Trevor Booker is doing in a game, unless it's just some ridiculous opposing lineup that has, you know, like a power forward at center or something.
And something that I think has been lost in the shuffle a little bit by, you know, all the chaos that's going on in the bottom half of the West is that since New Year's, Utah's been the best team of that group. They're plus 2.2, not 2.5. And I think that was before tonight's game, which is ninth in the NBA. It's ahead of the other three teams, Portland, Houston, and Dallas, that are kind of in that same mix right now. And their defensive rating during that time, which largely lines up with when Rudy came back, he came back the sixth, but that's close enough. Their defensive rating of 101.5 per 100 is fourth in the league. So they've been more like themselves. We talked about their crunch time stuff, but on the aggregate, they've been pretty damn good.
Yeah, and David Locke tweeted out that in their last 15 games, they are the number three defense, number one defense in their last five games, and really held down a Houston team that is still a pretty good offense, especially at home in this one. And yeah, I mean, if you throw out that period where Favors and Gobert were injured, yeah, they're kind of like right where they're supposed to be, really on pace for sort of a 45 win type of season that we thought from them. Instead, now they still have a 90% chance of making the playoffs. This is a huge win, beating one of their rivals on the road in a game that they were not projected to win. They are now projected to have a 41-41 record, and I think they are even in position now for the seventh seed. And they also got some good news, at least for them, with the Chandler Parsons injury that is really putting a damper on what Dallas's projection is going to be. Let's get to Houston, though. Where are they at record-wise and in the projections?
Houston is 35-37 now. They're 4-5 since the last time we did this, and 530 gives them a 74% chance of making the playoffs and an identical to Utah 41-41 projected record. So they would tie for the 7-8 if that were the case.
Yeah, and Utah has beaten them 2 out of 3 times now. They had that dramatic win in Utah as well about a month ago. And then Dallas plays at Oklahoma City and then in Utah on the second out of a back-to-back, which is pretty brutal. So if Utah wins that game, they will then have the tiebreaker. They will be the huge odds-on favorite for the seventh seed if they can win that one. And then the rest of the Rockets' schedule is brutal as well.
Yeah, so their schedule kind of splits in two. So they have tough games in Oklahoma City. They face the Raptors. They go at Indiana and Cleveland for an Eastern Conference road trip. Then they face the Bulls, OKC, and go at Dallas. And so they have that stretch. And then immediately after those hard games, they get the Suns, Lakers, Wolves, and Kings back to back to back to back. So how they handle that, and this is a team that is massively inconsistent, you know, so if they can win some of the games that maybe they shouldn't win, and they can avoid losing some of the games that they shouldn't lose, they'll be okay, but you can never bet on that with Houston.
Yeah, you would have to say that their next 5 games, all of them, they will not be favored in. And that's definitely a concern for a team that has a propensity to kind of get down on itself. On the other hand, you could make the argument that the only time they seem to play well is when their backs are truly up against the wall. So perhaps that will inspire them to play better, or if they lose those games, will inspire them to close pretty well. But you got to expect that Utah might get out to a little bit of a lead here, especially having won this one. Michael Beasley, coming into tonight, had a 40% usage rate.
Wow, that's even more than most Bates.
and also even more than the NBA record over a full season, which is 38%. I can't remember whether Russell Westbrook or Kobe owns that. But Beasley, now, in fairness to him, the goal for him has been to come in and score when Harden's on the bench. That's been his role. That Boston game that I was at a couple of weeks ago, he just shot every time. He had like 19 shots in 15 minutes or something like that. And that's what he's supposed to do. They have not really been that effective with him on the floor. On the other hand, he often plays without Harden, and he's just trying to give them some kind of shot creation and offense, what Ty Lawson, of course, was originally supposed to provide and never did. Dwight Howard also has just completely disappeared offensively. It's gotten to the point now where they don't even bother running post-ups for him, even when Harden is out of the game. He's not even really getting like that many pick-and-roll lobs either. And it's really, you know, I don't even necessarily think of him as an above-average offensive center anymore, especially considering the fact that he doesn't make his foul shots.
Yeah, and it's amazing how that can happen. Have you seen much of Demo since he's really come back?
No, you know, I haven't. Most of the games that I've watched of them, he's done the Keith Bogans, and then they've just finished up going a little bit smaller. But you know, he might even be a better post-up option than Dwight is at this point. That's what Calvin Watkins was saying on Twitter today. I think I might agree with him, especially if you've got Demo being guarded by the other team's power forward. He'll usually have an advantage against that guy.
Yeah, and especially with his skill doing that in most NBA fours, especially as we move towards an era with more stretchy guys, aren't as used to just defending it. Because Dwight, you know, he's going against guys who have dealt with that their whole careers.
So, Danny, what is your favorite burrito place in San Francisco?
Oh, God, I think it's El Farolito. I'm just trying to remember off the top of my head.
Well, I know that mine is El Farolito. Yeah. It is awesome. Fantastic Al Pastor burrito. They were actually the number one seed in 538's burrito bracket. Were upset by La Taqueria in what I thought was an absolute travesty. There's no way La Taqueria is better than El Farolito. But neither of those places deliver. So if you want to avoid having to wait in their justifiably long lines, what can you do? Well, you could order using the Postmates app from these two San Francisco institutions, or you can order from whatever iconic burrito place or any other restaurant you want to order from in your town. Postmates is available in all major U.S. cities, and if you use the CapSpace code familiar to longtime listeners of the show, you can get $10 off your first delivery. That'll cover basically a free delivery, and you can get whatever you want delivered. It doesn't even have to be food. It could be something from 7-Eleven. It could be toilet paper. It could be paper towels. It could be anything that you want. Postmates will deliver it for you. So use that CapSpace code on Postmates. Get the $10 off. Let them know that you came from us, and you can get yourself some awesome food delivered right to your door.
The Dallas Mavericks are 35-36. They've been 2-6 since the last time we did this, and that, you know, they're still in the playoff mix, but I feel like that is a temporary condition, at least a little bit.
Projected now for a 39-43 record, that is two games behind where Houston and Utah are projected, which is rather significant at this point in the year with really about 10 games left. 36% chance at the playoffs. Houston is so schizophrenic that maybe that's realistic, but especially with Parsons out for the year, they still have a game at Golden State that's basically an automatic loss coming up on Friday. They have one wing that's playable now on the roster, that's Wes Matthews. They have no backup power forward on the team. They've had been trying to start Dirk at center along with Parsons and having a little bit of success there. Now Parsons is out for the year, and there's some rumors that he could potentially come back. This is a small meniscus tear in the same knee that he had the microfracture surgery on. It has been called unrelated. I'm skeptical of that, but it'd be really dumb for him to come back in this totally lost season.
It's prohibitively unlikely that even if they made the playoffs, they would be outside of the Spurs and Warriors buzzsaws. So for him, you know, maybe you're trying to gain a little bit of value in the contract, but his teammate Wes Matthews tore his Achilles and still got a substantial deal from the Mavericks. So I don't think he really needs to prove more than he already has. So I don't see much to be gained for him or for the team for that matter.
I agree with you. And other than just the ignominy of losing their draft pick to the Celtics and having it be a lottery pick as the final nail in the coffin of that Rondo trade, that pick is only top seven protected. There's no way they could tank sufficiently now to avoid giving that up. But also, just the history of players, two that come to mind are Brandon Roy and Meta World Peace, who had arthroscopic surgery, you know, a small meniscus trim, and then tried to come back for the playoffs, is not good. Neither of those guys really was ever the same after making that attempt.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're just kind of sitting there saying what's to be gained. And one thing that's kind of amazing just with the way that the league is structured right now is that if the Mavericks miss the playoffs, it's very possible, especially if they fall off a little bit more off the pace, that they end up with the 12th worst record in the league, which is, you know, not close enough where it's realistic for you to jump into the top three, but still a pretty solid pick for the, you know, for the Celtics to get.
Yeah, it would be a shame if that those kind of optics affected what they did. And I don't think they will. I can't think of a single example of someone in basketball who came back from a meniscus surgery in less than 6 weeks. And that barely ever happens, for one. And the two that it happened that I can remember, it worked out really poorly. Did go through a little bit of the numbers on them, though. They have played zone, been known for doing that a fair bit, had great success with it in the 2011 finals, for example. They have done that 7.2% of the time this year, and they're giving up 0.95 points per possession in the half court on those plays versus 0.90 when they play man. That probably is not just a fair description because you're going to usually play zone when you have weaker defensive lineups out there, but it hasn't been that effective. And with their lack of length on the perimeter, that's usually what can really help in a zone, and they just don't really have that. They have, however, been averaging 0.975 points per possession on post-ups as a team, and considering that the average half-court possession around the league is 0.90, that's really good when you consider that post-ups are such inefficient plays. Dirk, obviously, still a solid post-up player. They do a lot of work to get switches, get mismatches. Guys like Wes Matthews, Darren Williams, they can be very effective posting up once they get the switch on guys, and they can get a lot of volume on those post-ups because Dirk forces a lot of switches because you don't want to give up a shot to him in the pick and pop.
And because he spaces out that far, it's a lot harder to get help over there. So that's something that can help, let's say, a Darren Williams post-up in particular.
On the other hand, though, their stats for the pick-and-roll ball handler are average. And when you have Dirk on your team, that's not good because the big is always going to stick to him. That should open up driving lanes. But they just don't really have anyone who's an above-average athlete in the backcourt at this point. And they really got to get that guy. You know, Monte Ellis, for all that we deride him at times, his marriage with the Mavericks was a perfect one because he could still at least turn the corner and get to the rim, not the way he used to, but still better than anyone who's on the current roster. So I think this offseason, finding someone who can really attack off the dribble and finish at the rim with some dynamism should be a priority for them, but there just aren't that many of those type of point guards available on the market this year.
And they also don't have a ton in terms of assets. You know, they can use cap space and they can try to identify those guys, but it's not, they're not really going to be in the place to acquire one who's already under contract, unless it was somebody that the team's trying to sell on, and why would you be selling on them, especially to the Mavericks?
You know who would actually be a pretty useful guy for them off the bench? If they wanted to sign him, I doubt that they would. But Leandro Barbosa would be perfect for them. A guy who can just kind of get downhill in a straight line, not necessarily a great passer, but someone who could maybe run a pick and roll or two and just, you know, get 5-6 possessions a game where he can get going to the basket, you know, as someone who would still be pretty darn cheap as a budget signing. Let's move on to the Denver Nuggets, 30-42, but 5-4 after an unbelievable Emmanuel Mudiay shot that won them the game against the Sixers tonight at home.
Yeah, I mean, you have a situation, they didn't have any timeouts left, and so they had a couple of seconds, I think maybe like 5 seconds, and so they got, I guess that was about the best look they could get. Mudiay kind of fumbled the ball a little bit. Takes a deep three, and they win by one because that was as close as they could get to the basket. And against the Sixers, you have to feel a little bit bad for them just because, you know, it's a loss that was, in that way, was kind of not of their own making. But I think the Nuggets have played reasonably well, and one of the dynamics with this team is that the disincentive for them of flailing is a little bit reduced because they gobbled up the Knicks' ping pong balls.
Yeah, that's true, although I think if you looked at what we thought from both the Knicks and Nuggets at the start of the year, you would have thought that one of those teams would at least be in like the top 8 or 7, and it looks like neither of them is going to. They are now projected for a 34-48 record, which would put them right in the like 9-10. I mean, there are, I think, 5 teams clustered between a projected 32-35 wins right now, so they'd be in the lower end of that group. One thing that's been a little encouraging is that Yusuf Nurkic, who we'd kind of rung some alarm bells about in previous editions of the 15-60, he's starting to look a little bit better now. He had a really athletic block on LeBron the other day as they got blown out in Cleveland, but, you know, stared him down, starting to get a little bit of that enjoyable swagger back. So that at least is encouraging to see that defensively he's showing some flashes of getting back to where he was at times last year.
And even though Jokic has done a nice job this year, Nurkic is still an incredibly important part of their future. And if you can get, even if it's just 48 minutes from those two guys, because I'm a little bit skeptical of how they'll play together, you know, except for maybe some small spurts, that's an advantage that most teams don't have.
Yeah, you can't play those guys.
I don't think so.
Defensively, it just wouldn't be quick enough. Jokic, he's got to speed up his release on his three-pointer. But, you know, I think offensively, it wouldn't be the end of the world, especially since Jokic can pass as well. But I think on defense, there's no way either. Nurkic has the quick feet on occasion, but he doesn't have the instincts or the ability to crash into the lane and then close out to a three-point shooter the way you need to at the four position in today's NBA. And Jokic is way too slow to do that. So I don't see those guys as a combination. I do think that Jokic and Fareed is something that could work well. It's so disappointing that Fareed just is so bad defensively. If he could just be who he looks like he would be, things would be much better off for the Nuggets.
Yeah, that's a great point. And we also, I think we both think that they should go a little bit more small more often at the four, though. And that, you know, that opens up some defensive problems, but it also offensively could make it a lot easier on them.
Yeah, I mean, maybe what you could say is Jokic and Fareed are a pretty good fit, at least offensively. And Fareed, maybe he can still get coached up to be a little bit better on defense, or at least, you know, get out to where he can stay with shooters. And then if you wanted to go with Nurkic and Gallo, if Nurkic can start to fulfill his defensive potential a little bit more, then Gallo could play at the four with him. Gallo and Jokic, you just don't have enough athleticism. I mean, Jokic does what he can with his limited tools, especially for a rookie. He's actually impressive with his level of intelligence, but you're never going to be an elite defensive team, I don't think, with him at center, unless you have really good athletic pieces around him. And Gallo at the four, especially as he ages, is not necessarily that. So I don't know. Let me ask you this. Would you be trying to trade Gallo in the offseason? He has one more year left on his contract. He has a player option after that, which if he keeps playing the way he has this year, he undoubtedly would not exercise. He'd want to be a free agent next summer.
I would definitely listen. I don't know that I would seek it out. He's such a nice piece for kind of what they're trying to do. If he's interested in staying long term, he already did a renegotiate and extend, so he did get more money out of it, but that is a nice sign that maybe he's happy there. So I would be open to it. His age timeline, you know, I think he'll age all right, but I don't think he fits perfectly with the super young guys that are on this team. I mean, they have a really nice core under the age of like 23, 24. And so he's not going to be perfect with them, but he can be a transition guy. So I would listen, and Gallo is going to be in this group. But something I talked a little bit about on the Sporting News piece a couple weeks ago is that I feel like this is going to be a really hot trade market once teams see what these free agents are going to get. So it wouldn't surprise me if they got an offer that was good enough for me to consider it.
Yeah, if I'm Denver, I'm coming into this offseason with a plan for keeping DeGallo and going after some free agents that might actually really make a difference to me to get back to the playoffs next year. They're not that far away if they could make some signings. They're going to have, you know, $30 million in cap room or so. You get a leap from Moutier, Gary Harris, Will Barton, Jokic. I mean, they've got a ton of young guys who could potentially take a step forward. And then if you got one more piece in the wing, Wilson Chandler will be coming back as well. So I'd be willing to try that approach. But if you can't get someone who you really feel good about, they're like, all right, we're going to be back in the playoffs. And also you'd have to look at who you get with your draft pick too. You know, are you getting someone that's kind of has more long-term potential and is raw, or are you getting someone who's more sort of in the help right away vein? Or you might say, hey, you know, maybe we'll trade Gallo and we'll try to get some more assets and maybe punt our cap space back into 2017, 2018, 2019 instead, because I think what they don't want to do is tie up their space before guys like Moutier and Harris and Jokic, Nurkic, before those guys are really ready.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it.
Who's next here?
The Los Angeles Lakers. They are 15-56, 2-5 since the last time we did this. They are projected to have a 17-65 record, which is squarely in the second most ping pong balls, second worst record in the league. And that means, you know, when you're in that spot, you can push a little bit for wins if you want. I don't know how much Byron Scott is really focusing on that. And I know that you'd been following Julius Randle a little bit in since the last time we did this.
Yeah, I do want to get to him, but one thought that occurred to me as you're talking about that projected record, they won 27 2 years ago, right? And that was viewed as this impossible nadir, horrible, one of the worst seasons in Lakers history. How could they possibly be any worse than this? All right, we're going to make some free agent signings. We'll at least get back to respectability this next year. Then they won 21 games last year. oh, well, we got Roy Hibbert, we got Lou Williams, we got Brandon Bass now. At least Kobe's coming back. At least he won't be, like, so horrible. We got these rookies who at least are talent, guys who can play. We'll at least be better this year, right? You know, maybe we won't make the playoffs, but, you know, over-under was 29 wins this year. And now they're projected to win 4 less games even than that.
I don't even think they can hit their over-under now.
Oh, yeah, no, there's no...
I think it is physically, it is impossible.
Yeah, and it really is just remarkable. And maybe we gave short shrift to some of the guys who were on this team last year, frankly. You know, like, I mean, Carlos Boozer wasn't horrible. You know, starting him was ridiculous, but he was mildly effective. Jeremy Lin has been good this year. Ed Davis has been excellent. I mean, what if they just re-signed Ed Davis for the same amount that he ended up going to Portland for? You know, instead they spent their money on Lou Williams and Roy Hibbert. Ed Davis would look pretty good in a Lakers uniform under contract for these next couple of years.
And he would have been a great asset, too, if they needed it.
Yeah. Now, granted, they are going to keep their pick, so it's probably, again, is actually better for the franchise in the long term than if they had won 30 games this year and were giving up the pick to the Sixers. But that wasn't really what they were trying to do, at least outwardly. So, yeah, it's, you know, and even it's, they've, their biggest problem now is, as I kind of go through some of their stats, that Ed Davis would really help with, and, you know, Mike D'Antoni would have really helped with, too. They are 28th in offense by the pick-and-roll roll man, and that makes a ton of sense with their personnel.
Yeah, I mean, who do they have that's even a slight plus in that category?
You would hope that Julius Randle could be that. Hibbert obviously is horrible. He's one of the worst pick-and-roll big men in the league with his lack of athleticism and speed. But
Nance could do it eventually.
Yeah, but he's just been standing on the baseline in the corner and shooting long twos, you know, so he's not really being used that way. You know, Randall shows some flashes, to be sure. Like, what is he good at? He's good at the grab and go. He's got a nice handle. He can rebound. Though that's basically about all he's got at this point. He's got an okay passing vision at times. Like, he'll get tunnel vision sometimes, but he also can make some passes. The problem is he has a 481 true shooting percentage, which for a power forward is miserable. He's shooting 57% at the rim, and anything outside of 10 feet is basically a low 20% proposition for him. And so what's ending up happening is that great handle doesn't really help him because guys are just laying off him. He can't go by his man. Whoever's guarding him will just kind of back off, let him get to the rim, and then just contest. And, you know, a lot of times he's just going to miss it, and he doesn't get fouled all that much. He has no right hand still. He's working on it. He's had a couple of right hand finishes, but with his lack of length and especially the fact that guys are just kind of waiting for him, and it's usually his own man. You know, it's not even like the help defense comes over. He has to finish over help. It's just his own guy is kind of standing there waiting for him at the rim. He's got to get that right hand going to make up for the fact that it's really difficult for him to finish at the rim right now.
And it is true that the team structure isn't really helping him, not doing him any favors right now, but it's going to take a lot for him to really grow into that, especially when he's not, you know, he needs a straight power forward to me. He's not going to be that rim protector. So what you're looking for in a player next to him, if you're thinking he will be your starter, is a lot of different things.
Yeah, that's true. One of those is to get him the ball in pick and roll. I think that's where he can be successful, especially on teams that trap the pick and roll. The hope would be that D'Angelo Russell can become a good enough shooter that teams will have to employ that Steph Curry, Damian Lillard strategy on him. And then you can throw the ball to Randall at the top of the key and he can operate, get to the basket, make some passes. You know, hopefully he can grow into that role, or you're forcing them to switch. And then maybe he can be effective posting up, because he's not effective posting up regular power forwards. He doesn't have enough moves to really operate with his back to the basket. Doesn't have a right hand jump hook. Can't shoot like a turnaround jumper at all either. So he can't be effective posting up against normal power forwards, but I think he could be very effective posting up once he's gotten the switch and he just goes for the put the guy in the goal approach. But they have to get a center who's going to provide him with some more space, or at least someone who could catch an alley-oop on some of those plays, and space the floor better. They have no wings who can shoot either. You know, they're missing a lot, and he's not someone who's just going to be effective in any system. I mean, they're basically, the only way he's getting offense is ISOs. He's had 211 isolations this year, and he's passed on 50 of those, which is actually not horrible, but overall, isolations for him are not a way to be efficient. He doesn't have that sort of explosive athleticism, unless he's going to get a really good jumper, and then he could blow by guys. But he's a long way from that when he's shooting in the 20s from outside of 10 feet.
One thing I wanted to note is that the last time we did this, I made a note that the Russell, Clarkson, Randall trio without Kobe Bryant, which I think is the important way to analyze them, had only played 296 minutes together. That has jumped to 369, which is more, partially because Kobe missed some time. So that's kind of good, but it's still less than you would want to just have an understanding of where those guys are going to be.
All right, now that this is turning more into a 15 and 120 instead of a 15 and 60, we're actually going to take this to a part two that'll come out tomorrow night, since Danny is going to be on vacation. So we will talk to you all then.